University of Colorado.
Thank you for joining us for CU on the Air, the University of Colorado's official podcast. At CU on the Air, we talk to our outstanding faculty about their life-changing research and how it benefits our state, nation, and world. I'm your host, Ken McConnell. We're pleased to be able to bring you the best of all four CU campuses on CU on the Air.
That's what we're really trying to bring forth, is that this is a health issue. It's getting worse. We have the ability to change it, and therefore we should think about how we're going to do that. We're trying to make that link.
They are two very big fields, climate change and global human health, and our guest today, Dr. Jay Lemery, is working at their confluence. He is a doctor at the CU Anschutz Medical Campus and co-author of Environmedics, The Impact of Climate Change on Human Health. You've noted that many aspects of climate change can affect human health, and we wanted to talk about a few of those. Extreme heat events seem like a bit of an obvious issue, but also a bit of a sleeper issue for people when you think about global warming.
The hottest day of the year, people are more susceptible to heat stroke and heat illness. But really, it's more insidious than that. The hottest day of the year, of which there used to be one, now there might be 10 days or 2 weeks, well beyond the historical record for a given area. The people that we're most worried about in these extreme heat events are the most vulnerable. So those with diabetes, heart disease, congestive heart failure, kidney disease, they don't need much to push them over the edge. And then when the body is overheated, they may not have access to cooling or air conditioning. These are people that can have exacerbations of their chronic disease. So they'll come into the hospital. You know, they'll be sick or maybe even die from congestive heart failure, from diabetes, from heart disease. But what you have to understand is that that may have been what's on their medical record, but you have to correlate that with the weather outside and say this was the hottest day of the year. And these vulnerable people were pushed over from these extreme weather events. And that's where the hidden numbers lie, where the impact is the greatest.
Can you describe what vector-borne diseases are and why they're increasing?
Vectors are just bugs, so mosquitoes and ticks, and we know a lot of infectious disease is carried by these vectors. When you create more hospitable space for these vectors to live, to thrive, to procreate, what I mean by that is just warmer temperatures over a longer part of the year, what we're seeing is that they're spreading higher in latitude. In the U.S., they're going to more northerly states and places they haven't existed before, and higher in altitude. So places like East Africa, the mosquitoes that carry malaria moving to higher mountainous areas where those people had never had that exposure before. And we know that there's a risk of increased disease in these areas. They don't know how to protect themselves, and they may have, in some cases, a more severe form of the disease because they don't have an immunity built up.
As we're speaking, wildfires are raging in California. What does that do to the air and the people who are breathing it?
We're seeing longer seasons and more intense wildfires. And in the United States, we've seen a lot in the mountain west over the summer and in the west coast. Wildfires have the ability to degrade air masses over huge swaths of land and over big cities, so huge population centers. The particulate matter that is in the air, you know, so the particulates from the burning vegetation, irritate the lungs. And again, we think of vulnerable populations, those with existing pulmonary disease or asthma, or maybe the very young or the very old are more susceptible because the air that they're breathing is now degraded and they can go into a respiratory crisis from that.
Extremes in precipitation and drought are really affecting all over the world. How do they influence food supplies?
Drought, of course, degrades food supply. And you think of any impact from farm to the table, any perturbation in that supply chain can really impact food security. And we don't think too much about it here in the United States, but in, you know, parts of the world where food supply is very tenuous and the food chains are long and take a while to get from the fields to the table, that's a big impact. And a drought can devastate crops in entire nations. I think that has the ability to have one of the biggest impacts is that food security is going to be really at risk from these extreme weather events.
What aspects of climate change are we seeing here in Colorado, particularly as it relates to health?
Well, we're seeing wildfires. We're seeing worsening extreme precipitation events. When you think about the floods in Boulder a few years ago, I mean, the impact to property and human life was palpable. We're seeing increased drought. We're always at the risk of decreased snowpack, and that has real downstream implications for agricultural areas and, again, food supply. So we're certainly not immune. And this is sort of a pattern that's playing out all over the American West.
Can you talk to us about forced migration?
Yeah, forced migration is just when people have to move for a certain reason or a number of reasons. Certainly drought and then increase in civil conflict, of which climate change has been associated with exacerbating in places with poor governance. These are all considered to be forced migrations. One of the other big causes that we are seeing and will definitely see in the next century is sea level rise, particularly with the nations of the Indian Ocean and the South Pacific. These nations will just cease to exist. So now we're seeing more resettlement happening in nations like Australia and New Zealand, where these populations are truly having an existential crisis. One of the other examples that we've seen in the United States with forced migration is this summer with Houston, or even 12 years ago with Katrina. Climate change was not the sole reason it happened, but we know that we'll be seeing more of these types of events in the future based on the prediction models. And when you look at the forced migrations of these vulnerable communities in New Orleans, and if you look at a map, very powerful maps that are out there of the diaspora or the citizens of New Orleans who are now living in other parts of the U.S., you see that almost every county in America has citizens from New Orleans from 2005. And those are essentially climate refugees.
Will yoking global health issues to climate change discussions raise the profile of this discussion, make it more real for people?
Yeah, we hope so. There's very few things that people are more concerned about, that pay more attention to, than the health of their loved ones, their friends and their families. That's what we're really trying to bring forth, is that this is a health issue. It's getting worse. We have the ability to change it. And therefore, we should think about how we're going to do that. We're trying to make that link. It's been a very difficult process.
Despite things like the terrible hurricane season we saw this year, wildfires, many people still view climate change as kind of an abstract thing that's out there in the future. Does linking it with health make it more real?
Absolutely. Climate change has historically been messaged through altruism. So, you know, love Mother Earth, you know, save the whales, or abstractions, parts per million of carbon dioxide hit 400. And what does that mean for most people? Science communication has generally failed in this regard. And now I think when you bring it to an issue where you can talk about the health of your family and your kids' risk of asthma, that has a whole nother meaning for people. And again, the goal is to change risk assessment and say, we need to understand that this is going to impact our health and we have to change the way we view it in terms of our risks.
Do people make the connection between climate change and some of the health issues that we're talking about?
I've been surprised that people, even physicians, when you sort of link climate change with extreme weather and the impact on human health or extreme heat events or even mental health, the aha moments that I get still suggest to me that a lot of people aren't getting it or haven't thought much about it.
People have their head in the sand.
Yeah, I mean, there's a lot of noise out there, right? I think it's just a matter of understanding, is getting the message to people.
Are some of these extreme weather events shoving it more into the mainstream?
Yeah, without a doubt. You know, it takes a crisis or a tragedy or an extreme event to get people to pay attention to it, right? So I think what happened, you know, in Houston this year and, you know, Puerto Rico and the Virgin Islands and then the wildfires, I think more and more people are realizing that these are not isolated events, but it's part of a greater pattern. So with that comes a chance to reassess, and hopefully we're understanding that this is a problem that we're gonna have to face head on. And I think viewing it through a healthcare lens helps us really see the impact in a way that everyone can relate to.
And do you think people have an overly optimistic view of the risks associated with climate change?
I'm not sure I would call it overly optimistic. I think people don't know. And I think if anything, there's a sense of helplessness. There's a sense of confusion. There's a sense that these are quote unquote natural fluctuations that humans have not really been a factor in. And I think as the science is emerging, we all know that this isn't true. This is human caused, But the good news is that if it's human caused, it can be human fixed. And I think that's what we're trying to push, particularly understanding that the impacts are big. You know, I think we've seen a lot this past year in the United States that these extreme weather events have real impacts, and hopefully people understand that they're not so far removed from it. They're in a position to actually affect change.
And it seems like certainly the discussion, but the pace of climate change seems to be accelerating. Do you see the discussion about global health impacts of it accelerating as well?
I would say it's becoming more conspicuous and more people are talking about it. Certainly in the global health world, climate change is playing a larger role in terms of impacts and efforts to mitigate against it. It does seem in the United States that more and more people are accepting it slowly. So I think there's cause for optimism. I think the question is going to be the pace. Is the pace of our change enough to keep up with the pace of climate change? It accelerates at different levels, but I think there's no question that the prediction models that even we knew 10 years ago have borne to be true, and the science is getting better every year to suggest that it will keep happening for the next several decades and into the next centuries.
And is the field growing?
I think the field is slowly growing. I think medicine is a very slow to move. Truthfully, the most traction we've gotten is with the medical students and residents. They get it. They want to know more. They're excited about it. I think when we talk about the ossified, board-certified physicians, of which I guess I'm one of them now, it's just harder. It's harder to sort of change the way people think. And I think a lot of it isn't necessarily any other reason than doctors are confident in knowing what they know, and things that they don't know, they don't necessarily feel like they can venture out and speak authoritatively about it. I think our messaging is, you know health. This is sickness. And if you're an orthopedic surgeon or an obstetrician, you still know what sickness is. We sort of invoke the white coat to say you can speak authoritatively on this. You may be professionally, but even personally within your own constituency and your friends and family to you know, say that this is a big deal and we need to pay attention to it.
You pay attention to the science of climatology, I would imagine. Do climatologists pay attention to global health aspects?
The way we approach this is that we're healthcare providers, and that's really where our recommendations come, is that we know sickness. This is sickness. But to understand it, you have to pay attention to what the data is telling us. And in researching the book that we just wrote, we had to pay real close attention to what was happening with environmental science, because that's how you distill the impact to understand what's happening with health. I think we're pretty clear that we're not primary researchers in environmental science, but the data is there, and extrapolating that to human health is actually pretty straightforward.
Unfortunately, climate change has gotten politicized, and it's out there in the political discourse, and probably not in the best way. As you've noted, the evidence is quite clear that this is real, this is happening, and this is going to get worse. But does having physicians involved in this discussion perhaps move it out of the political realm a little bit?
I hope so. That's the whole goal, is that physicians have always been a trusted part of people's lives. And when you can articulate that obesity is bad, smoking is bad, sugary snacks are bad, this is the same messaging. And I don't think it has to be politicized when physicians do what we've always done. We bring forth the best science and we distill it into recommendations. All day long, we're science communicators. You know, I sit down and say, hey, you need this surgery. You really should take this pill. And, you know, second opinions notwithstanding, people generally say, okay, doc, we still have the benefit of the public trust. And I think that's something that's very, very important.
Shifting gears, but related, you've done work on global health responders. You produced a massive open online course that you've delivered, and you're refining. What was the response to that course?
Yeah, it was amazing. You know, the massive open online courses, we call them MOOCs, is a whole new way of teaching. Historically, if a professor was able to get 400 or 500 students into a room, that was incredibly popular. Our courses had over 10,000 people take it. And that's actually very low numbers for MOOCs. We also had people from over 130 nations take it, which was, you know, phenomenal when you're talking about a global health course. It was very exciting and very dynamic. We created it so people of all backgrounds could take it. It was an introductory course, you know, sort of a backgrounder on global health and how to get involved. The feedback we got was fantastic. We did it 3 or 4 years ago, and it's still very relevant today.
When disasters happen, many people are altruistic, and they hop on planes or they go to disaster areas, but rushing in might not always be the best approach.
Well, that's right. That's one of the big things we talked about, is that you do have to be prepared, particularly with humanitarian disasters, to help, even if you have a real expertise at home. So you may actually be a prominent surgeon or a nurse or an administrator and very good at your job in the United States, but popping into a humanitarian crisis, all those skills which you had in a resource-rich environment, you really need different types of skills. And so that was one of the big messages we talked about. And very much we learned that from our work in Haiti, where it was an easy place to get to, but it was a desperate situation. And a lot of the first responders that landed there actually ended up becoming victims themselves and compounding a disaster in an already tenuous place.
What's the difference between disaster response and what you've called responsible engagement?
So disaster response is in the aftermath of an earthquake or a hurricane or a civil war even. And I think those are things that have emergent and really desperate situations. I think responsible engagement, particularly when in the context of global health, is having a sustainable relationship where both parties have a lot to bring to the table. We often think about, we come from a resource-rich place, so we have resources, but it's not always a good thing just to show up with resources and think you're doing anything meaningful. So we really try to build a lot of the global health programs along the lines of education and reciprocity. So our colleagues in other nations are able to educate us and show us and our students a different type of pathology, a different type of patient. And in turn, we're able to bring our educational background to them and hopefully build some capacity within their ranks so they can deliver healthcare to their people long after we're gone.
Are there some particularly good examples of where that system works?
There's lots of people doing great work. Here at CU, we've got our faculty working in South Africa and Ghana, helping to build healthcare systems to increase the capacity of our colleagues there. There are programs that exist where nurses and young physicians can go abroad and again, in a Peace Corps model, help build capacity in a local environment. And through a funding mechanism here in the U.S., they're able to pay off their student loans.
How did you get interested in climate change and its effects on health?
I started off doing a lot of wilderness medicine education out of residency, and that's kind of the art and science of how you take care of people in remote and austere places. It was a real derivative of emergency medicine, which, of course, is what my day job. And then I began to think about wilderness medicine is really a dual mandate to take care of people in remote places, but also the fact that a remote and austere places, a healthy environment, is integral to human health. And I began to think about the larger conversations about climate change and the impact on health and the conspicuous absence of the clinical community in that. And the more I dug, the more I realized it was a niche that needed to be fulfilled and no one was really doing it. And so that's what kind of drew me into it.
And how long have you been at that?
I've been doing that since about 2007, 2008. I was really inspired by my mentor and my co-author, Paul Auerbach, who's the former chair of emergency medicine at Stanford. He wrote an essay in the Journal of the American Medical Association, JAMA, called Physicians in the Environment. And I read it in 2008. We were friends and I immediately called him. I was like, this is amazing. You know, we've got to push this through in medical schools and the curriculum, and we've got to start teaching this. And then from that initial conversation came the book idea.
What's been the reaction to your book?
It's been pretty positive, actually. I think the one thing that we wanted to do is take the reader to the bedside, and it was written just for that, for lay people. So we wanted to get away from abstractions or even a public health voice where we speak in terms of large populations. We actually wanted to speak in terms of individuals. And one of the features is we did these clinical vignettes of composite patients that my co-author and I have had our career seeing. So when we talk about heat stress, we can tell you exactly what that looks like. When we talk about infectious diarrhea from an extreme weather event and degraded water quality, we can tell you what that feels like. Same thing with forced migration from climate change. I think that's one of the things we wanted to do, is give readers a palpable sense of really what's at stake in a way that maybe they hadn't heard before.
And you've had private individuals come forward and provide financial support.
We're seeing a lot more people in the private sector be interested in helping what we're doing. There's a Denver-based nonprofit called the Living Closer Foundation, and they have supported a physician fellowship in climate and health policy here at CU, where we're taking one of our young physicians for a year and sending, in this case, it's a her, we're sending her to the CDC in Atlanta, to the NIH in Washington, and to have this young physician really be in the room where the climate and health policy discussions are happening and basically become an insider and be a real agent for change when the fellowship is over.
How does it feel to be what to me seems to be a pioneer on this frontier?
It feels like we got a lot of work to do. I mean, it feels, this came out of a need. You look around and like probably most people, you want to leave the world a better place for your kids. I'm a physician. I work in healthcare. I also run an educational program in wilderness and environmental medicine. And to me, it slowly became an elephant in the room. Like, why aren't we talking more about this? This is so clear to me in the world that I'm in. And then the more you explore, the more you realize there's so much to learn and so much to share. And it just became a calling. So I just feel like I can't think of anything more important we should be doing right now. We just finished a book and there's a lot of work left to be done.
Well, we're glad you're out there doing it.
Thank you for having me.
Dr. Jay Lemry is an associate professor of emergency medicine and wilderness and environmental medicine at the University of Colorado School of Medicine. He is co-author of Environmedics, The Impact of Climate Change on Human Health. Thank you for joining us for CU on the Air. The University of Colorado comprises four campuses, Boulder, Colorado Springs, Denver, and the CU Anschutz Medical Campus in Aurora. To learn more about CU, go to www.cu.edu. Thanks to our producer, Kathy Buten, and audio engineer, John Arnold. I'm Ken McConnellog, and we'll see you on the air next month.
University of Colorado.